Her hand groped for a wrist as it clutched her sheets. She slid over on the small convertible bed to make room and pulled him down beside her. Marnes wrapped his arms around her back, wiggled beneath her until she was lying on his side, a leg draped over his, her hands on his neck. She felt his mustache brush against her cheek, heard his lips purse and peck the corner of hers. Jeanne's held his cheeks and burrowed her face into his shoulder. She cried, like a schoolchild, like a new shadow who felt lost and afraid in the wilderness of a strange and terrifying job. She cried with fear, but that soon drained away. It drained like the soreness in her back as his hands rubbed her there. It drained until numbness found its place, and then, after what felt like a forever of shuddering sobs, with sensation taking the place of that. Jeanne's felt alive in her skin. She felt the tingle of flesh touching flesh, of just her forearm against his hard ribs, her hands on his shoulder, his hands on her hips. And then the tears were some joyous release, some welcomed sadness of a moment long delayed and finally there, arms wrapped around it and holding tight. She fell asleep like that, exhausted from far more than the climb, nothing more than a few trembling kisses, hands interlocking, a whispered word of tenderness and appreciation, and then the depths of sleep pulling her down. The weariness in her joints and bones succumbing to a slumber she didn't want but sorely needed. She slept with a man in her arms for the first time in decades and woke to a bed familiarly empty, but a heart strangely full. In the middle of their fourth and final day of climbing, they approached the mid-30s of IT. Jeanne's had found herself taking more breaks for water and to rub her muscles along the way, not for the exhaustion she feigned, but the dread of this stopover and seeing Bernard, the fear of their trip ever coming to an end. The dark and deep shadows cast by the power holiday followed them up, the traffic sparse as most merchants had closed for the silo-wide brownout. Juliet, who had stayed behind to oversee the repairs, had warned Jeanne's of the flickering lights from the backup generator. Still, the effect of the shimmering illumination had worn on her during the long climb. The inconstancy was bothersome. When they reached the 34th, Jeanne's felt like they were, in a sense, home again. Back in the realm of the familiar, at the main landing for IT, she waited by the railing, leaning on it and her walking stick, while Marnes got the door. As it was cracked open, the pale glow of diminished power was swept off the stairwell by the bright lights blooming inside. It hadn't been widely publicized, but the reason for the severe power restrictions on other levels was largely due to the exemption IT maintained it possessed in spite of this holiday. Bernard had pointed to various clauses in the pact to support this. Juliet had bitched that servers shouldn't get priority over grow lights, but resigned herself to getting the main generator realigned and taking what she could. Jeanne's told Juliet to view this as her first lesson in political compromise. Juliet said she saw it as a display of weakness. Inside, Jeanne's found Bernard waiting on them, a look on his face like he'd swallowed sour fruit juice. A conversation between several IT workers standing off to the side quickly silenced with their entry, leaving Jeanne's little doubt that they'd been spotted on the way up and expected. "Bernard," she said, trying to keep her breathing steady. She didn't want him to know how tired she was. Let him think she was strolling by on her way up from the down deep, like it was no big deal. "Marie." It was a deliberate slight. He didn't even look Marnes's way or acknowledge that the deputy was in the room. Would you like to sign these here or in the conference room? She dug into her bag for the contract with Juliet's name on it. What games are you playing at, Marie? Jeanne's felt her temperature rise. The cluster of workers in silver IT jumpsuits were following the exchange. Playing at? She asked. You think this power holiday of yours is cute? Your way of getting back at me? Getting back? I've got servers, Marie. Your servers have their full allocation of power, Jeanne's reminded him, her voice rising. But their cooling comes ducted from mechanical, and if temps get any higher, we'll be ramping down, which we've never had to do. Marnes stepped between the two of them, his hands raised.
Easy,
he said, coolly, his gaze on Bernard.
Call off your little shadow here,
Bernard said. Jeanne's placed a hand on Marnes's arm.
The pact is clear, Bernard. It's my choice, my nomination. You and I have a nice history of signing off on each other's, and I told you this girl from the pits will not do.
Well, she's got the job,
Marnes said, interrupting. Jeanne's noticed his hand had fallen to the butt of his gun. She wasn't sure if Bernard noticed or not, but he fell silent. His eyes, however, did not leave Jeanne's.
I won't sign it. Well, then next time I won't ask.
Bernard smiled.
You think you'll outlive another sheriff?
He turned toward the workers in the corner and waved one of them over.
Why do I somehow doubt that?
The worker approached. Bernard nodded to the young man, a face familiar to Jeanne's from level meetings.
Sign whatever she needs. I refuse to. Make copies. Take care of the rest.
He waved his hand dismissively, turned and looked Marnes and Jeanne's up and down one final time, as if disgusted with their condition, their age, their positions, something.
Oh, and top off their canteens and see that they have enough food to stagger back to their homes, whatever it takes to power their decrepit legs to wherever it is that they belong.
And with that, Bernard strode off toward the barred gates that led into the heart of IT, back to his brightly lit offices where servers hummed happily, the temperature rising in the slow-moving air like the heat of angered flesh as capillaries squeezed, the blood in them rising to a boil. 8. The floors flew by faster as they approached home. In the darkest sections of the staircase, between quiet floors of people hunkered down and awaiting a return to normalcy, old hands wrapped around each other and swung between two climbers, brazenly and open, grasping each other while their other hands slid up the cool steel of the rails. Jeanne's only let go sporadically to check that her walking stick was secure against her back, or to grab Marnes's canteen from his pack and take a sip. They had taken to drinking each other's water, it being easier to reach across than around one's own back. There was a sweetness to it as well, this carrying the sustenance another needed, this being able to provide and reciprocate in a perfectly equitable relationship. It was a thing worth dropping hands for, momentarily at least. Jeanne's finished a sip, screwed on the metal cap with its dangling chain, and replaced it in his outer pouch. She was dying to know if things would be different once they got back. They were only 20 floors away. An impossible distance yesterday now seemed like something that could slip away without noticing. And as they arrived, would familiar surroundings bring familiar roles? Would last night feel more and more like a dream? Or would old ghosts become more and more solid? She wanted to ask these things, but talked of trivialities instead. When would Jules, as she insisted they call her, be ready for duty? What case files did he and Holston have opened that needed tending to first? What concession would they make to keep IT happy, to calm down Bernard? And how would they handle Peter Billing's disappointment? What impact would this have on hearings he might one day preside over as judge? Jeanne's felt butterflies in her stomach as they discussed these things. Or perhaps it was the nerves of all she wanted to say but couldn't. These topics were as numerous as grains of dust in the outside air, and just as likely to dry her mouth and still her tongue. She found herself drinking more and more from his thermos, her own water making noises at her back, her stomach lurching with every landing, each number counting down toward the conclusion of their journey, an adventure that had been a complete success in so many ways. To start with, they had their sheriff, a fiery girl from the down deep who seemed every bit as confident and inspiring as Marnes had intimated. Jean saw her kind as the future of the silo, people who thought long-term, who planned, who got things done. There was precedence of sheriffs running for mayor. She thought Juliette would eventually make a fine choice. And speaking of running, the trip had fired up her own goals and ambitions. She was excited for the upcoming elections, however unopposed she might be, and had even come up with dozens of short speeches during the climb. She saw how things could run better, how she could perform her duties more diligently, and how the silo could have new life breathed into old bones. But the biggest change was whatever had grown between herself and Marnes. She had even begun to suspect, just in the last hours, that the real reason for him never taking a promotion was because of her. As deputy, there was enough space between them to contain his hope, his impossible dream of holding her. As sheriff, it couldn't happen. Too much conflict of interest, too much his immediate superior. This theory of hers contained a powerful sadness and an awe-inspiring sweetness. She squeezed his hand as she thought on this theory, and it filled her with a deep hollowness, a cramp in her gut at all he had silently sacrificed, a massive debt to live up to no matter what happened next. They approached the landing to the nursery and had no plans for stopping to see Juliette's father, to urge him to receive his daughter on the way up. But Jeanne's changed her mind as she felt her bladder beg for release.
"Oh, I've got to go pretty bad," she told Marnes, embarrassed as a child to admit she couldn't hold it.
Her mouth was dry and her stomach churning from so much fluid and maybe from a little fear of the journey being over and done.
"I wouldn't mind seeing Juliette's father, either," she added.
Marnes's mustache bent up at the corners with the excuse.
"Then we should stop," he said.
The waiting room was empty, the signs reminding them to be quiet. Jeanne's peered through the glass partition and saw a nurse padding through the dark corridor toward her, a frown becoming a slight smile of recognition.
"Mayor,"
she whispered.
"I'm sorry not to have wired ahead, but I was hoping to see Dr. Nichols and possibly use your restroom."
"Oh, of course,"
she buzzed the door and waved them through.
"We've had two deliveries since you last stopped by. Things have been crazy with this generator mess."
"Well, power holiday,"
Marnes corrected, his voice gruff and louder than theirs. The nurse shot him a look, but nodded as if duly noted. She took two robes from the racks and held them out, told them to leave their stuff by her desk. In the waiting room, she waved toward the benches and said she would find the doctor.
"The bathrooms are through there."
She pointed at a door, the old sign painted on its surface nearly eroded clean away.
"I'll be right back,"
Jeanne told Marnes. She fought the urge to reach out and squeeze his hand, as normal as that dark and hidden habit had lately become. The bathroom was almost completely devoid of light. Jeanne's fumbled with an unfamiliar lock on the stall door, cursed under her breath as her stomach churned noisily, then, finally, threw the stall open and hurried to sit down. Her stomach felt like it was on fire as she relieved herself. The mixture of welcomed release and the burn of having held it too long left her unable to breathe. She went for what felt like forever, remained sitting as her legs shook uncontrollably and realized she had pushed herself too hard on the climb up. The thought of another 20 levels mortified her, made her insides feel hollow with dread. She finished and moved over to the adjoining toilet to splash herself clean, then dried herself with one of the towels. She flushed both units to cycle the water. It all required fumbling in the darkness, unable to see and unfamiliar with the spacing and location that were second nature in her apartment and office. She staggered out of the bathroom on weak legs, wondering if she might need to stay one more night, sleep in a delivery bed, wait until the morning to make the climb to her office. She could barely feel her legs as she pulled open the door and returned to Marnes in the waiting room.
"Better?"
he asked. He sat on one of the family benches, a space left conspicuously beside him. Jeanne nodded and sat heavily. She was breathing in shallow pants and wondered if he'd find her weak to admit she couldn't go any further that day.
"Jeanne, are you okay?"
Marnes leaned forward. He wasn't looking at her, he was looking toward the ground.
"Jeanne, what the hell happened?"
"Oh, your voice," she whispered.
He screamed instead.
"Doctor, nurse!" he yelled.
A form moved beyond the dusky glass of the nursery. Jeanne laid her head back against the seat cushion, trying to form the words on her lips to tell him to keep it down.
"Oh, Jeanne, sweetheart, what did you do?"
He was holding her hand, patting the back of it. He shook her arm. Jeanne just wanted to sleep. There was the slapping of footsteps running their way, lights turned up forbiddingly bright. A nurse yelled something. There was the familiar voice of Juliet's father, a doctor. He would give her a bed. He would understand this exhaustion. There was talk of blood. Someone was examining her legs. Marnes was crying, tears falling into his white mustache, peppered with black. He was shaking her shoulders, looking her in the eye.
"I'm okay,"
Jeanne tried to say. She licked her lips, so dry, mouth so damn dry. She asked for water. Marnes fumbled for his canteen, brought it to her lips, splashing water against and into her mouth.
She tried to swallow but couldn't. They were stretching her out on the bench, the doctor touching her ribs, shining a light in her eyes. But things were getting darker anyway.
Marnes clutched the canteen in one hand, rubbed her hair back with the other. He was blubbering. So sad for some reason, so much more energy than her. She smiled at him and reached for his hand, a miraculous effort. She held his wrist and told him that she loved him, that she had for as long as she could remember. Her mind was tired, losing its grip on her secrets, mouthing them to him as his eyes flowed with tears. His eyes, bright and wrinkled, peering down at her, then turning to the canteen in his hand, the canteen that he had carried. The water and poison meant for him. 9. The generator room was unusually crowded and eerily silent. Mechanics in worn coveralls stood 3 deep behind the railing and watched the first shift crew work. Juliet was only dimly aware of them. She was more keenly aware of the silence. She leaned over a device of her own making, a tall platform welded to the metal floor and arrayed with mirrors and tiny slits that bounced light across the room. The light shined on mirrors attached to the generator and its large dynamo, helping her get them in perfect alignment. It was the shaft between the two of them that she cared about, the long steel rod the size of a man's waist, where the power of combusting fuel was transformed into the spark of electricity. She was hoping to have the machines on either end of this rod aligned to within 1/1000th of an inch, but everything they were doing was without precedent. The procedures had been hurriedly planned in all-night sessions while the backup generator was put online. Now she could only concentrate, could only hope the 18-hour shifts had been good for something, and trust in plans made back when she'd had some decent rest and could soundly think. While she guided the final placement, the chamber around her stood deathly quiet. She gave a sign, and Mark and his team tightened several of the massive bolts on the new rubber floor mounts. They were 4 days into the power holiday. The generator needed to be up and running by morning and at full power that next evening. With so much done to it, the new gaskets and seals, the polishing of cylinder shafts that had required young shadows to crawl down into the heart of the beast, Juliet was worried about it even starting up. The generator had never been fully powered down during her lifetime. Old Knox could remember it shutting itself down in an emergency once, back when he was a mere shadow. But for everyone else, the rumble was as constant and close as their own heartbeats. Juliet felt inordinate pressure for everything to work. She was the one who had come up with the idea to do a refit. She calmed herself with reassurances that it was the right thing to do, and that the worst that could happen now was that the holiday would get extended until they sorted out all the kinks. That was much better than a catastrophic failure years from now. Mark signaled that the bolts were secure, the lock nuts tightened down. Juliet jumped off her homemade platform and strolled over to the generator to join him. It was difficult to walk casually with so many eyes on her. She couldn't believe this rowdy crew, this extended and dysfunctional family of hers, could be so perfectly silent. It was like they were all holding their breath, wondering if the crushing schedule of the last few days was going to be for naught.
"You ready?" she asked Mark.
He nodded, wiping his hands on a filthy rag that always seemed to be draped over his shoulder. Juliet checked her watch. The sight of its second hand ticking around in its constant path comforted her. Whenever she had doubts about something working, she looked at her wrist. Not to see the time, but to see a thing she had fixed. A repair so intricate and impossible, one that had taken years of cleaning and setting parts almost too small to see, that it made her current task, whatever it was, feel small by comparison.
"We on schedule?" Mark asked, grinning.
"We're doing fine," she nodded to the control room. Whispers began to stir through the crowd as they realized the restart was imminent. Dozens of them pulled sound protection from their necks and settled the muffs over their ears. Juliet and Mark joined Shirley in the control room.
"How's it going?"
Juliet asked the second shift foreman, a young woman, small but fiery.
"Oh, golden,"
Shirley said as she continued to make adjustments, zeroing out all the corrections that had built up over the years. They were starting from the ground up. None of the patches and fixes of old to disguise any new symptoms. A fresh start.
"Oh, we're good to go,"
she said. She backed away from the controls and moved to stand near her husband. The gesture was transparent, leaving the controls. This was Juliet's project, perhaps the last thing she would ever try and fix in the down deep of mechanical. She would have the honor and the full responsibility of firing the generator up. Juliet stood over the control board, looking down at knobs and dials that she could locate in utter darkness. It was hard to believe that this phase of her life was over, that some new one was about to begin. The thought of traveling to the uptop frightened her more than this project could. The idea of leaving her friends and family, of dealing with politics, did not taste as sweet to her as the sweat and grease on her lips. But at least she had allies up there. If people like Johns and Marnes were able to get by, to survive, she figured she'd be okay. With a trembling hand, more from exhaustion than nerves, Juliet engaged the starter motor. There was a loud whine as a small electrical engine tried to get the massive diesel generator moving. It seemed to be taking forever, but Juliet had no idea what normal sounded like. Mark stood by the door, propping it open so they could better hear any shouts to abort. He glanced over at Juliet as she continued to hold the ignition, creases of worry in his brow as the starter whined and groaned in the next room. Someone outside waved both arms, trying to signal her through the glass.
"Shut it off, shut it off," Mark said.
Shirley hurried over toward the control panel to help. Juliet let go of the ignition and reached for the kill switch, but she stopped herself from pressing it. There was a noise outside, a powerful hum. She thought she could feel it through the floor, but not like the vibration of old.
"It's already running,"
someone yelled.
"It's already running,"
Mark said, laughing. The mechanics outside were cheering. Someone pulled off their ear protection and hurled the muffs up into the air. Juliet realized the starter motor was louder than the rebuilt generator, that she'd been holding the ignition even as it had already started and continued to run. Shirley and Mark hugged one another. Juliet checked the temps and pressures on all the zeroed gauges and saw little to adjust, but she wouldn't be sure until it warmed up. Her throat constricted with emotion. The release of so much pressure, work crews were leaping over the railing to crowd around the rebuilt beast. Some who rarely visited the generator room were reaching out to touch it, almost with reverent awe. Juliet left the control room to watch them, to listen to the sound of a perfectly working machine, of gears in alignment. She stood behind the railing, hands on a steel bar that used to rattle and dance while the generator labored, and watched an unlikely celebration take place in a normally avoided workspace. The hum was magnificent. Power without dread. The culmination of so much hurried labor and planning. The success gave her a new confidence for what lay ahead, for what lay above. She was in such fine spirits and so fixated on the powerful and improved machines that she didn't notice the young porter hurry into the room, his face ashen, his chest swelling with the deep gulps of a long and frantic run. She barely noticed the way the news traveled from mouth to mouth throughout the room, spreading among the mechanics until fear and sadness registered in their eyes. It wasn't until the celebration died completely, the room falling into a different sort of quiet, one studded with sobs and gasps of disbelief, of grown men wailing, that Juliet knew something was amiss. Something had happened. A great and powerful thing had fallen out of alignment, and it had nothing to do with her generator.
Wool, Part 3, Casting Off. 1. There was a number on each of the pockets. Juliet could look down at her chest and read them, and it had nothing to do with her generator. Wool, Part 3, Casting Off. 1. There was a number on each of the pockets. Juliet could look down at her chest and read them, and so it occurred to her that they must be printed upside down. They were there for her to read, and for no one else. She numbly stared at them through her helmet visor while the door behind her was sealed. There was another door, a forbidden one, looming in front of her. It stood silently as it waited to be opened. Juliet felt lost in this void between the two doors, trapped in this airlock full of its brightly colored pipes, all jutting from the walls and ceiling, everything shimmering behind plastic-wrapped shrouds. The hiss of argon being pumped into the room sounded distant through her helmet. It let her know the end was near. Pressure built against the plastic, crinkling it across the bench and walls, wrapping it tightly around the pipes.